Let's roll with an open line some other night. Tonight, we're just focusing on magic. And it's always nice when you've got an expert like Philip Carr Gom to explain the book of English magic. What happened in England? What made it so special? What made it so unique as a place where magic thinking grew and where magical thinking still dominates? What with the opening here this weekend of the Harry Potter movie, the second to last installment of the Harry Potter movie series. And what about you? Your questions about magic, about druidism, about magical thinking in general, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. The book of magical thinking of sorts. It's the English book of magic, but Philip Carr Gom can go with you on your questions and comments about magic. Jim is in Washington State on Coast to Coast. Jim?
Hey, Ian. Hey, Phil. Thanks for having me.
Hi.
I actually had a comment and a question. And my comment was, it's basically kind of a challenge to the listeners. I know that a lot of people would hear about magic and whatnot, and it's kind of got a negative connotation, you know?
Yeah.
But I was a military police officer for a while.
Yeah.
And my entire life was basically, it revolved around taking and kind of conquering the universe, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
a lot of chaos, a lot of conflict in my life. But I'd met a Buddhist gentleman who he proposed a challenge to me, and he said, look, go out of your way to not do any harm. Just go out of your way to do no harm and to be it's basically like the threefold rule with a lot of magic circles. Basically, just do good and see what happens. And it's the easiest test in the world, and it's the most I had immediate results. I mean, the universe stopped being that challenge, and it started to be more of a giving and receiving entity rather than just some place that I live in. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's one of the key ideas of magic, really, is that you get back what you give out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. You had a question?
And my question actually involves animals. I noticed in a lot of magic circles, there's a lot of relationships to animals, specific animals. And I've had a few odd occurrences, but I was wondering, why are animals so intergrained in the actual magical circles?
Sure. Okay, about 15 years ago, with my wife Stephanie, we published a book and a card deck called The Druid Animal Oracle, where we took exactly the question that you asked, and we looked at the way in the Druid tradition and the Celtic tradition, there's a whole bunch of teaching about animals, different animals and their symbolism and what they mean if you encounter them and so on. And so we created that. In many magical traditions, animals are seen as bringing certain gifts. And of course, the very simple way we know how what gifts, say, a dog or a cat can bring to us in our lives. But every animal has a kind of quality. It's like a plant. Same thing with the plant world and the tree world and the human world. Just as every human has a particular kind of gift or quality that they can perhaps bring to us. So it's the same thing with the animal world. And animals, actually, when you start to get into this, if you start to undertake magical journeys in consciousness where you go in your imagination, some people would say, or in your astral body, other people might say, you travel into the other world, you discover these various other dimensions and realities. Often animals will act as guides and helpers in that world.
Animal sacrifice has been a part of a lot of traditions. Is it a part of the Druidic tradition?
No, absolutely not. There's no use of animals in sacrifice at all. No.
What about human sacrifice in the in the ancient form? Well, you laugh, but I mean there are these stone tables that they have found both in ancient England, even in, I believe there's one that was found in America that had sluices cut into the edges. There's certainly all around the world and other places where that type of thinking goes on, but no to animal, to human sacrifice.
No to human sacrifice. There was, if you go way back into the past, I mean, animal sacrifice was used in every tradition, in the Judaic tradition. I mean, even in Christianity, I mean, there's this weird kind of customs, like there's some church in Spain where they used to take a goat up to the top of the church and throw this live goat. down into the crowd, or where they used to stone pigeons up until quite recently and on a certain festival day of a saint or something like that. So killing animals has sadly been a part of certain practices around the world for a long time, and also human sacrifice as well in certain cultures, but it certainly plays no part in modern Druidry at all.
Okay. Was it ever part of ancient Druidry?
There's a story that Julius Caesar wrote about how the Druids were priests who officiated at the execution of criminals, and they would be put into wicker men. And this is where the Wicker Man story, the famous film, came from, is that they would, he said that the Druids would build, or the culture would build, huge frames of wicker and stuff them full of the criminals and so on, and then would set fire to them, and the Druid priests would officiate at these things. It's generally believed this isn't true, because if you actually created a big figure out of wicker and stuffed it full of people, it would soon fall over. There would be all sorts of problems. If you set light to the wicker, the wood would burn, all the guys would jump out and run after you and so on. So it's a very impractical kind of thing. So it seems as if he was engaging in propaganda. He had another agenda, which was to paint the people outside of the Roman Empire as being sort of barbarians who needed to be civilized by Rome.
Okay. TJ is in, right on the Iowa-Minnesota border. Go ahead, TJ.
Philip and Ian, welcome, Merhaba. Philip, I'm Saxon by DNA.
Yeah.
I consider myself to be a Catholic Christian convert of my own volition in Christ, St. Patrick, St. Barbara, St. Hubert. And I know a great deal about St. Patrick. My feet have been on Ireland. I want to hear more of Robin Hood Longstride, because he did utilize the magi, the jugglers of England, but he did it for good purpose. And the magi, as a Catholic, were the wise men, but they were late for the party. The shepherds, the humble, were the first ones to arrive, and I like to be first for the party.
Okay.
And stay a long time.
All right.
Talk to me, Philip, of Robin Hood. The real Robin Hood was a soldier before he became an outlaw, and he loved widows, orphans, pretty girls, and a good party.
All right. Any thought on that? Does that come into your comfortable with that?
Do you know something? You know what you've touched on. Your core has touched on is this fabulously rich amount of story and folklore and tradition that we have that goes back thousands of years. And no one person can know it all or encompass it all. So do you know something? Robin Hood is one area that I haven't studied particularly. So I'm sorry I can't talk to you about specifically.
But in the movie version of Robin Hood, the Sheriff of Nottingham employs witchcraft.
Uh-huh.
And the, at least, well, I say the movie version, in a
yeah.
movie version of it, in the still can't live this down quite Kevin Costner version of Robin Hood.
The Men in Tights version.
Yeah, I like the Men in Tights version.
Yes.
But there's that, there's the witch that is employed by the Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yeah.
So even, you know, I don't know whether that has any basis.
Sure.
That's
a really interesting point, because witchcraft and the kind of was originally seen as evil, and a number of different things were going on. I mean, we've already talked about how, you know, the woman down the road who was curing people, if she ever screwed up, you know, God help her, because then people would think she had done it. But as well, at one level, it was blackmail. You would have people who would come around and who would demand money, you know, beggars in a way, saying, look, you know, if you don't give me a little bit of money to stay alive, you never know, I might cast a spell on your cattle, or you might have a blight on your land. So there was a use, a kind of cynical use of fear. Again, we see how magic works with either trust or fear, and put very simplistically, evil magic, bad magic, works with people's fears, and good magic works with people's trust and love of life.
Let's bring this to Bill in Santa Rosa, California, on Coast to Coast. Bill, you're talking with Philip Carr-Gomb. Go ahead.
Hi, Philip and Ian. Yes, what I want to bring up is how a magical, mystical, musical moment can occur through what I believe is power of suggestion hypnotically, and it actually happened when you played I Got a BMW for the bumper music, and I was feeding my black cat. So it incorporates something that we may have going into like a soundtrack for our life, and I'd like to specifically align this with power of hypnotic suggestion along with that music and hypnosis through a psychologist. Aren't those modern forms of magical spells in effect?
Well, let's ask a magician and a psychologist, Philip.
They are, absolutely, which is why a study of magic and a study of psychology is just a perfect combination. You know, so I studied psychology and psychoanalysis and trained in psychotherapy and all the rest of it, as well as training with the old chief druid and training in magic and so on. They work very well because, I mean, exactly as you say, and you were talking about the music. I mean, you know the way you can go to a fabulous concert, you know, where they're using lighting and music and sound and color and all the rest of it, and you can have these kind of epiphanies or moments of altered states of consciousness. And you might turn to your friend and say, wow, that was magic. And it was magic. You know, there's a way in which actors and artists and creative people understand, some of them anyway, understand that they're actually doing magic.
Well, there are, as you mentioned earlier, people who practice black magic. Are there people who practice black psychiatry?
Well, I don't know. You could say that some of the psychiatric practices, have been, with hindsight, I don't think anybody, you know, I think even psychiatrists who were using, you know, ECT and stuff like that in the past, and all that, they thought they were trying to help people. I mean, in practice, you can look back and look at some of the history of psychiatry as the black arts. Whether or not they consciously were trying to damage people, I suspect not.
You know, I'd be willing to go on a limb here and say that a lot of what we now know the CIA, for all I know, MI5 was doing it too, or MI6, but the CIA was definitely doing a lot of these mind control experiments using soldiers, using unwitting college students, and I think I think psychologically, that was a practice of the dark arts.
Yeah. I think you can. You know, that film Men Who Stare at Goats, which they've made recently, which is based on, you know, a lot of that material that you can find in that book, Psychic Discoveries Behind the Iron Curtain, for instance. Certainly on both sides of the Cold War, they were engaging in practices that were, you would term, the dark arts, where they were trying to use forces to essentially to create harm, to harm people.
Well, or even just to flagrantly attempt to manipulate and then kind of figure out later on what they would do with it. You know, they might even have never even got to the part of harm. But it does speak to the famous saying, Aleister Crowley is the one who's credited with it for so many reasons. I'm guessing it's older than him. But do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, or do what thou wilt and do no harm is another version of that. Is that something that is central to Druidism?
No, because do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law doesn't include the concept of love and of letting go to a higher power. It's putting all the power in your own hands. Do what you like. Essentially, you know, you can then add the rider on it, but don't harm anybody. But still, it's not an axiom that we use.
Okay. Very good. Let's go to Chris in Atlanta on Coast to Coast on a first-time caller line for Philip Carr Gumm, the Book of English Magic.
Hello, Ian. Hello, Philip.
Hi there.
Hi. I've been a practicing druid for the better part of 17 years.
Great.
I was trained by a druid that was trained by a brotherhood in England. I was wondering if there's any way to get in contact with your brotherhood so that I might be able to pick up my training again.
Sure. The easiest way is just to type druidry.org, www.druidry, that's druid and then R-Y, .org. Druidry.org, and you get onto our website. And basically, when I was trained, the way you trained was you went to visit a druid. So a couple of times a week. I mean, beginning when I was going to school, I would go and visit the old chief druid, and he would train me and so on. And then when he appeared to me 9 years after he died, he said, look, this stuff isn't some kind of strange, old-fashioned, eccentric thing. The world actually needs magic today. The world is in a very dire situation, and it needs magic. It needs people who are working with these seeds of light. Put everything I taught you into the form of a distance learning course so it can travel all over the world, so people don't have to travel to you to learn it. And so I did that. And when I did that, I thought, this was back in 1988, I thought just a couple of dozen people would be interested. And the last 20 so years have been just incredible. I mean, about 12,000 people have taken this training. It's published in French and German and Portuguese and Italian and Dutch and Czech. We have, you know, thousands of members in the States. And it takes the form. You know, if you contact us, what we can do is we can send you this material. And it takes the form. It's written material or it's on CDs. So if you want to listen instead of hear. And, you know, it's been wonderfully put together over the years with, you know, Scottish and Irish and Welsh and English voices and music and stories and meditations and ceremonies and so on.
That sounds good. Hey, Chris, you live in Atlanta?
Yes.
Do you live in Druid Hills?
No.
Okay, just checking. That's a neighborhood in Atlanta called Druid Hills.
Yes, I've heard of it.
Yeah, I don't know if there's actually any druids in Druid Hills, but you would know. I wouldn't know. Let's go to Mike in Livermore, California, on Coast to Coast. Mike?
Good morning, Ian. Good morning, Philip. Great show. Earlier, you're talking about chaos. You're like stating my life. I am very creative in woodworking and fabrication, everything else, and I come up with projects, and the first part of it is total chaos. I overthink everything. I do not want to make a mistake. I think it. I play devil's advocate on everything, all the way down the subject. And when I finally put my hands on it and start working, it all comes together. And then I get bored with it. I want to walk away from it.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking, am I doing something wrong? Do I need a protege and an assistant to finish a job out for me? And then I also have a question after that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if we have time for that, we may not have time, but go ahead to address Mike's first point.
Okay, first point. Magic works with the two core principles of magic. It's symbolized by the magic wand and the chalice or the cup, the cauldron, the grail, all these things. And they represent two processes that can help you hugely in creativity. That's why I love magic and I love druidry, because, you know, we work with these two dynamics and it helps our creative and artistic lives so much. The wand is the male analytical directive, the power of focus. If you want to do anything in this world, if you want to achieve anything or create anything, you've got to be focused. But you can't just be focused. You've got to be open. You've got to allow the chaos. You've got to open up, symbolized by the cup, this sort of feminine principle where you allow the chaos. You align new ideas and feelings and thoughts to come in and so on, let it all mix around. And then at a certain moment, so you've got to learn when to pick up the wand, when to put it down, and when to use the chalice. And magical training is all about how I can use the chalice and the wand, how I can use these two dynamics to be more effective in the world.
That's interesting. So you could say the wand is the phallic symbol and the cup is the gynocentric symbol.
Yep.
In druidry.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Interesting. All right. Sorry, I didn't have enough more time for you, Mike, but let's get to everybody. There's so many people trying to get through. We'll get to your questions and comments. Philip Carr Gom, the chief druid, and the author of the book, The Book of English Magic. We'll talk a little bit more about the English style of magic with a question that occurred to me in the last caller coming up next, too. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. And we have one wild card line open if you want to take it. Otherwise, we'll get to every call that we can for Philip Carr Gom, the author of The Book of English Magic. And a question about English rock and roll magic next, too, on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Let's get started again with Linda in Canada on Coast to Coast for Philip Carr Gom. Linda?
Hi. I'm really enjoying your show tonight, Ian. And Mr. Cardone, I really enjoy your knowledge. What is that again, dear?
Cargom, just so you know.
Cardom. Very
Gom,
lovely.
With a G. Thank you.
Very lovely. Well, I guess you were talking about Dionne Fortune earlier in your show. And there's one lady that how I came across her was just incredibly amazing. I was in a section of a bookstore where it said it had religious books. And a book was in there, and I picked it up, and I thought, what is this book doing here? And anyway, it mentioned her name, and it talked about her book, you know, Psychic Self-Defense. Yeah. But Dionne, I bought almost all her books and read about her. She was phenomenal, even in the Great Battle of Britain, you know, the Magical Battle of Britain.
Sure.
That, you know, she really fought well with. And her books, by the way, she was a great advocate of helping people, fighting the dark arts. You know,
yeah.
In her book, she writes about the outer planes and the inner planes. And I've read about it, but I don't really understand it. I have somewhat of a knowledge, but do you understand the outer and inner planes? Like, I see something like that in The Matrix or some of Harry Potter, the, you know, film. Okay. Somebody has knowledge of that.
Philip?
Do you know about that?
Yeah, sure, Linda. Yeah. One of the most exciting ideas about magic is the fact that, you know, that there are these other planes or worlds or realities or levels of consciousness, however you want to call it, which we can actually explore. So we carry on through life thinking that we're just in this world here, and then we die, and then we have these kind of strange dreams that, we can't quite figure out. And then when we come across the idea of magic and we start to explore it, we discover that there's these other realms that we can actually travel to and visit. And so the inner planes is Dionne Fortune's term, the term that she's using to designate what some people might call, in Druidry, we call it the other world, for instance. Some people might call it the inner world and so on. And these are other levels of reality, other realities that you can visit. And so part of the fun and the excitement of magic is learning how to travel in awareness into the inner planes in order to learn stuff, to develop and grow, to have adventures, and then to come back into the outer plane, which is this world, and hopefully be of some use to people.
Philip, as long as she's bringing up Dionne Fortune again, then
yeah.
That's a woman who was also associated with Aleister Crowley, right? They were compatriots and co-writers?
They weren't friends, let's put it that way.
They were not friends?
No, she knew of him, but I mean, she was very much... I wouldn't say they were friends, no.
Okay. Well, you know, just to wrap up a thought about him then, Aleister Crowley is often associated with the work of Led Zeppelin and a lot of other an influence on British rockers, heavy metal artists.
Yeah.
Are there any musicians that come out of England that are either druids or live up to a more, what you would consider a more centrist or more authentic understanding of English magic?
Sure. If you look at the theme of Druidry in modern music, it's very interesting. I mean, you find, you know, John Lennon in his Mind Games song talked about some kind of Druid dudes lifting the veil. Some call it magic, the search for the Grail. So, you know, the Beatles were aware of the Druids and what they meant. Around the time they were at the height of their power, a guy called John Michel published a book called A View Over Atlantis, where he talked about England as a magical country with the Druids and so on. So it was very much in people's minds in the 60s. And you even had, you know, people like in the sort of the punk world, Killing Joke and various things like that, people who were exploring consciousness and who knew of the Druids. There was even a prog rock group that I only learned about yesterday, actually, called the Fluid Druids. They weren't very successful.
The Fluid Druids.
There's a Canadian rapper called Gruff the Druid who's got one track on iTunes, which is just great.
And he's a real druid-type druid?
Sorry?
And he's a real druid or just...
I don't know if he's a real druid. He likes the druids, if you listen to the lyrics. But then you have people, there's the band called Afro-Celts, for instance, who do wonderful fusion music of African and Celtic stuff. And that was started by, there are a couple of druids in that band. And our patroness, we have a patroness who is Robin Gibb of the Bee Gees, his Robin Gibb's wife, and Robin Gibb are great friends of the Order, and so there are lots of kind of interesting connections around popular music and Druidry.
Very good, thank you. I appreciate that. Nadine is in Indiana on a wildcard line for Philip Carr Gom. Go ahead, Nadine.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I have a question about practicing magic versus practicing organized religion.
Hmm.
I've always felt drawn to witchcraft, and as a teenager, I kind of started getting interested in it, researching it, and my mom freaked out, and not because of practicing witchcraft, but I found out she had done it when she was younger,
uh-huh.
only she got mixed up in the wrong side of it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry. I was born and raised a Mormon, and I was blessed when I was born, and then when I was the appropriate age, I was baptized, and then when I was older, I was also baptized in the temple. I don't know if you know anything about the Mormon religion.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, and for the dead. So I can honestly say that there's not a prayer that I've ever said. I just have been very blessed. But yeah. The thing is, the gnawing about practicing magic has always been there, and it's just been recently I came upon a book, because I still, it's always there, but the fear to take that next step is always there preventing me because I'm afraid. I'm not a practicing Mormon anymore. I haven't been for years and years.
Well, hang on a second. Let's go ahead and get a thought in here. And let me just say, you know, there's a strong tradition of Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon tradition, who has a connection with magic and the occult as well, a lot of the early things that Joseph Smith dabbled in were along these lines. So you've actually, I think, are safe to have this conversation. What would you say, Philip, to Nadine? Go ahead.
Yes, as regarding Joseph Smith, by the way, there's a section in the book on him. We actually talk about that connection. But I think, if I'm right, the question you're asking is about, is it okay for you to explore magic? Is that the essence of what you're
asking? I think that's what she's getting at. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think that the real key, it's right to be cautious. And anyone who's read the book, The Book of English Magic, will know that we take a kind of cautious and rational approach to this subject, because it's easy for people to take the wrong direction or to misunderstand things or to go into the world of fantasy and all the rest of it. But anything worth doing has a risk. Anything worth doing has some kind of risk. You know, just so the thing to do is, if you choose a way that is connected with nature, with the natural world, where the magic you're doing is for the good of the world. It's not selfish. You're not just trying to get stuff for yourself, but it's because you want to be a better person. And B, it's working with the natural world, with the, you know, with trees and with nature and with the elements and so on. There's a safety in that. That's why I love Druidry again and Wiccan. There's a connection between Druidry and Wiccan. Some people combine the two. It's because there's a safety in that, and there's something healing about working with trees and stones and the earth and the sky. That's a kind of way, a touchstone for you to make sure you're going in the right direction, I think.
And didn't Joseph Smith use a seer stone?
He did, like John Dee. John Dee was famous because he had this crystal ball that you can see in the British Museum. At the end of the book, we suggest a kind of a walk in London where you connect with all these amazing places. And the walk starts in the Enlightenment Gallery of the British Museum. And there in a glass case is the crystal ball that John Dee and his scryer, his psychic, Edward Kelly, used to look into this crystal ball and to see spirit. And Joseph Smith also used the stone, and he said that he would hold that. He would sometimes put it in his hat, or he would hold it to his forehead in order to get psychic visions, and in particular to look for treasure. John Dee was looking for treasure. There's a whole sort of theme of magicians also using their powers to find treasure. Because a lot of magicians usually like everybody in this world, are kind of trying to find money, and they try to use magical means in order to find cash.
Yeah, and it was in pursuit of that that he ended up finding, you know, according to the Mormon tradition, the tablets.
Yes, and in fact, when he was assassinated, he was found on his body, there was found a magical seal that comes from a book by Francis Barrett called The Magus. So we talk about this in the book there. He was wearing a magical protective seal that unfortunately didn't work in his case.
No.
But he was steeped in it.
There you go. The Book of English Magic is what we're talking about. Abe is in Kentucky on Coast to Coast. Abe?
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. Mr. Cargom, it's an honor to speak with you. I had a couple of questions. I was wondering if you believe or do you think that Druidism will become a recognized religion in America in the future?
Well, I think it already is, isn't it, Abe?
That question is whether it's a tricky question because religions don't really need to be recognized. You know, I mean, they are what they are. I think probably what you're saying is, you know, is Druidry going to be accepted in the States in the same way it's accepted in the UK? In the UK now, we've recently had a kind of interesting breakthrough where Druidry is accepted for charitable purposes, for tax purposes as a religion. And it's very acceptable in the UK to say you're a Druid. In the States, I know people are more wary of it, and they worry about coming out of the closet, as it were.
Right. And I was also wondering, do you believe that Druids will help in the transition into the new age, you know, past 2012 and that sort?
Yes, I think Druidry will, and I think any spiritual work that's being done, I think we're all part of a team, you know. All these different spiritual approaches, they may seem different, but under the surface, you know, everybody's working, you know, in this way. And I think Druidry has a part to play because there's something about returning to the source and to the roots of our spiritual heritage and tradition that can help us. And with its reverence for nature as well, working with the powers of nature, which is just what we need at this time.
You know, the last caller, Abe, was from Kentucky, and I think there's that fascinating aspect of the work of J.R.R. Tolkien, who, as you write about in the Book of English Magic, emblematic in a way of that kind of magical thinking. He was a great example of stories that were told that kind of worked on a number of levels, but all involved magic. But that so much of the magic of which he spoke comes from Kentucky. There was a classmate at Oxford who was from Kentucky who used to tell stories about the characters that lived in his area and the types of old kind of what people might consider to be sort of back hills philosophies that ended up working their way into Tolkien's work.
How fascinating.
Yeah, that I can't remember. The guy's name was Barnett. I can't remember his first name, but he was there on a scholarship at Oxford. Brian is in Reno, Nevada on Coast to Coast for Philip Cargom. Brian?
Hi, Ian. Hi, Philip. How are you?
Hi.
I had a question about earlier you'd mentioned something about darkness and Rasputin. I just wondered if you could elaborate on that, because I'm in the Eastern Orthodox Church, primarily the Russian Orthodox Church, and I have a good friend that wrote a book about Rasputin. He went to Russia, and I just wonder what you could talk about to elaborate on what you made in the form of a comment about Rasputin earlier in the program.
Okay, well, you know, I don't know too much about it. What I do know is that he was obviously a very powerful healer. And I think the Tsar and Tsarina's son had hemophilia, which is that problem where if you cut yourself, you bleed and you can't, you know, your blood doesn't clot, so you can bleed to death from a cut. And so his health was very delicate. And Rasputin was able to heal him and to maintain his health, which is why he was considered so valuable. Apart from that, you know, I honestly don't know to what degree we've built up an image of him as being evil, when I mean, maybe, I don't know, maybe he wasn't. I'm not actually sure what evil he actually did. It seems like we all have a need to create these big bogeymen.
Well, I would fill in a blank on him, and that was this. There were two things about him that were evil, and we could see it. One was that he was a hypocrite. He demanded and spoke of a kind of aestheticism that he did not practice. Mm-hmm. So he was one that took full advantage of the royal household and all of the wine and the women. He was kind of a debauched figure in his personal life, but still to the first family of Russia projected an image of a holy man. Uh-huh. So in that sense, he was a bit of a charlatan. And as far as like his ability to heal, I'll give him the benefit of the doubt on that. But the healing goes back to something we mentioned before, and that's the ability to use words and to influence people with kind of thought seeds. And for whatever it is, he was able to sort of charm the young prince in the royal household so that he didn't bleed to death by slowing down his heart rate, would seem. Okay. And he was able to talk him into just being very, very calm despite all of the panic around him whenever he would cut himself, and therefore giving the clotting agents a chance to catch up with the cut.
Okay.
That's how I've always understood it.
Interesting. Yeah, thank you.
I don't have a name up on my screen, so in the time that we have Chris is on the first-time caller line in North Carolina. Chris?
Yes.
You're talking with Philip Carr Gom. Go ahead.
Good morning. How you doing? I just have a quick question. I have a real close friend. He's a practicing Wiccan. Yeah. And my question is there any connection between the origins of Druidry and the Wiccan practices? And if so, what are they?
Okay, great. My teacher in the 1950s was friends with the chap who originated Wicca. Wicca developed in the middle of the 20th century, around the 1940s, 1950s, out of a blend of a whole load of inspirations, including medieval Christian magic, old folklore, the witchcraft of the past, and so on. It's a kind of modern synthesis that developed. And this chap, Gerald Gardner, along with various colleagues like Dwayne Valiente, developed it into a system which is now called Wicca. And it's it's similar to Druidry, to modern Druidry, which it has 3 degrees of initiation. We have 3 degrees of initiation as well. It uses a magical circle. You create a magical circle in which to do your ceremonies. You follow an eightfold calendar of the year, the solstices, the equinoxes, and the quarter days in between. So we have the same seasonal rituals. So there are many similarities. For that reason, I wrote a book called Druidcraft, because I discovered that a lot of people were combining Druidism and Wicca together in a kind of practice that we call Druidcraft. And then the Druidcraft Tarot as well. So we published the Druidcraft Tarot, which was a way of working with the tarot and sort of learning all about the connections between Druidry and witchcraft. So they are very similar, yes.
Real quickly, and I only have about 30 seconds, Philip, do you celebrate Christmas?
We celebrate the winter, so we celebrate kind of Druid Christmas, which is a couple of days before the winter solstice. And then I guess we have what you would call a secular Christmas with all the presents and the trees and all that stuff.
So it would be okay then for people to give the Book of English Magic as a Christmas present.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time and for your openness and all the conversations we had going tonight. Very much enjoyed it. Wish we could have gotten everybody on who called. The Book of English Magic. Philip Carr Gom. You can link up to him through our website at coasttocoastam.com. Thank you so much. Look forward to talking to you again in the future. Deus te amat, and I do too.